You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
On Friday, May 8, 1970, Willis Reed, the captain of the New York Knicks, strode from the tunnel onto the court at Madison Square Garden and into the collective memory of New Yorkers and basketball fans around the world. It was the final game of a seven-game championship series, and Reed, playing with an injured leg, hit his first two shots and, in effect, broke the spirit of the Los Angeles Lakers. It was the Knicks' first NBA championship, and just 3 years later, after they acquired backcourt legend Earl the Pearl Monroe, the Knicks won a second championship. And those Knick teams have come to be regarded as among the smartest, on and off the court, that have ever been assembled. New York Times columnist Harvey Arreton tells their story, which took place in a time of racial and social unrest, political assassinations, and the Vietnam War, in When the Garden Was Eden, Clyde, the Captain, Dollar Bill, and the Glory Days of the New York Knicks. The book is published by Harper, and I'm very pleased that it brings Harvey Arreton to our studios today. Hello.
Pleasure to be here.
Before we talk about the glorious past, can we take a couple of minutes to discuss the troubled present? Were you surprised by the decision of the NBA players to reject the league's latest offer, which is likely to mean that there'll be no basketball season this year?
I was actually a little bit, because it seemed to me the players were on the verge of surrender. And I think what happened is that David Stern's ultimatum rouse them. I mean, these are competitive athletes, and I think if the NBA owners and Stern collectively had given them an opportunity, thrown them a few bones at the last minute, as opposed to saying, take this or leave it, and if you do leave it, the offer is going to get much more punitive, I think that got their backs up. And, you know, now they're, you know, it looks like they're willing to at least call the owner's bluff on whether they are really willing to go ahead and sacrifice the season.
Well, they've disbanded the players' union, and now they're filing an antitrust suit. You think it's likely they'll win it?
Some of the experts that have been quoted in the last couple of days say it is an uphill climb. I do think the players went into this action with the hope that the owners would reconsider the ultimatum and say, okay, let's come back to the bargaining table and start from the 50-50 split where they left off. You know, what we have to remember here is that the last lockout, which is 98-99, they did not settle that until early January, and the season did not start until, I believe, February. It was a 50-game season that ended maybe a week and a half later than usual. So there is plenty of time for them to actually get a negotiated settlement. But, you know, this is unlike the difference in this particular situation from the last one is that David Stern is dealing with a much larger group of small market owners who really want to, you know, even the competitive playing field.
What was the situation in the 1970, the years that you're writing about here? What was the top salary on the Knicks teams during that time?
Well, Bill Bradley had the biggest salary when he signed with the Knicks after spending 2 years at Oxford. So he joined the team in 67. He signed for $500,000 over 3 years. So it was quite a difference. And his contract created quite a stir.
He was called Dollar Bill as a result?
He was called Dollar Bill because of that.
Although his father was a banker, there were other reasons to call him Dollar Bill.
Yes, exactly. But, you know, he came after the whole two-year buildup. And, you know, Bradley himself in the book freely admits that, you know, much of the appeal was that he came from Princeton. There was that famous college game between Princeton and Michigan at the Garden and the Holiday Festival several years earlier where they packed the house. And the Knicks president or the president of Madison Square Garden, Ned Irish, saw the box office appeal in Bradley. And so, of course, Bradley understood quite well that he was the first great white hope.
The other star in that game was Cassie Russell, wasn't he?
Yes, and in fact,
so the Knicks wound up with both of those stars.
Yes, because they won a coin toss with the Detroit Pistons. They had the worst team, the worst records in the league, and as it turned out, the Pistons were represented in that coin toss by Dave DeBuscher. So a little bit of karma going there, and the Knicks wound up winning, and they took Cassie that year. And the following year, they took Bradley with what they used to call the territorial pick, where teams could pick a player who played in college in their region.
It was a whole different time. That territorial pick was meant to excite the fans. It's the reason that Wilt Chamberlain wound up with the Philadelphia Sixers and other players wound up on teams that sometimes were already well-stocked. You had to pray that good players were not playing in Boston colleges.
Well, you know, many people believe that the territorial picks were that mentality was still in place in 1985 when the Knicks miraculously won the Patrick Ewing lottery. A lot of people felt that that might have been rigged. I'm not one of them. But, yeah, it was, you know, the NBA has long tried to create a sense of, you know, of excitement in the various regions.
Now, the Knicks were, they joined the NBA in 1949. Should we be surprised that they had never won a championship until 1970?
Well, yes. Well, but the big part of that was because one team was so thoroughly dominant, you know, for many of those years. The Boston Celtics won 11 titles in 13 years during the Bill Russell era. And, of course, the Knicks succeeded them in the year after Russell retired by winning the title in 1970. But the Garden was, although it was considered the mecca of basketball, the Knicks did come close in the early 50s. They reached the finals three times under Joe Lapchick. And, in fact, one of those years they lost to the Rochester Royals, who had Red Holzman in their backcourt. And, in fact, it was Red who apparently dribbled out the end of the game. And he was a clever man because he kept the New York fan base hungry for a championship until he wound up coaching it.
My guest is Harvey Arreton, who's been a sports columnist for the New York Times since 1991. Before that, the New York Post?
I was at the Daily News before that and the New York Post before that.
His latest book is When the Garden Was Eden, Clyde the Captain, Dr. Bill, Dollar Bill, and the Glory Days of the New York Knicks. It is published by Harper. What was it about that particular act, Willis Reed coming out of the tunnel and onto the court in the Garden for warm-ups, that has made it something so memorable, one of the great moments in sports?
Well, first of all, I think that there was a sense of destiny about that team from the start of the season. You know, you knew Russell was gone. The team got off to a tremendous start. There was a game in Cleveland, Ohio, where they came from behind. They scored a flurry of points to beat the Cincinnati Royals, who were playing upstate for one game. And it was sort of considered a miraculous win. It also set a new record for consecutive victories. It was their 18th in a row. And so I think from the very beginning of that season, there was a sense that this was going to be their year. And as far as, you know, the Willis Reed, the whole buildup to him, I think what we have to remember was that the Knicks had won the fifth game of that series without him. He had gotten hurt in the first quarter. They won that game. It was considered a miracle win. The next game, they got blown out in Los Angeles, so they come home. And again, this was a time when there was no 24-hour sports talk, no ESPN, no Twitter or Facebook. So nobody really knew what was going on. I mean, the Garden switchboard had lit up all day, wanting to know, is Willis playing? So the drama built hour by hour. And, of course, the team did take the court without him. So, you know, they were warming up, and I don't think the players even knew whether he was going to play.
How did the Lakers respond to the frenzy that accompanied his appearance?
There's a lot of legend about how the Lakers dealt with it. And
who were the stars of that team?
Well, Wilt Chamberlain, Jerry West, and Elgin Baylor.
Not a bad lineup.
No, it was like the late 1960s, 1970s version of, you know, today's Miami Heat. And although that team, like the Heat, carried around some serious baggage, the Lakers had lost some excruciating championship series, including the previous years against Boston, where they lost Game 7 in their own building. But there will be many people who attended that game, and the players, the Knicks players who played in it, will swear on a stack of old Knicks yearbooks that they saw the Lakers, you know, the fire and competitive spirit go out of their eyes when Willis came out of the tunnel. The Lakers in the book all deny it. There is a sense, if you watch the video, the Channel 7, the ABC broadcast, that of course was shown on delay tape in New York, of seeing Chamberlain take a little stroll toward midcourt as if to see what's going on here. And a lot of people feel that Wilt was a little psyched out in that game.
How had Willis Reed injured his thigh in the first place?
Well, he had was having problems with his left knee. And there was a chapter in the book where I, having spent some time in Grambling, Louisiana, where Willis lives, we actually watched a video, an old scouting tape, black and white video, of Game 5. And in fact, he had never really seen the game, other than the 10 minutes or so that he played in it. He had never seen it because he was back in the locker room listening to Marv Albert on the radio. So when I came up with this video, he was thrilled that he would get to actually see it. And as he watched it, he realized that he had been having some problems with his left knee. So he was probably favoring it and putting too much stress on his right leg. And as he went to dribble around Wilt Chamberlain early in the game, he kind of just fell forward and fell face down onto the court. And what he wound up doing was tearing a muscle, a hip flexor muscle that sort of starts around his hip and goes all the way down his leg. And, you know, he was in excruciating pain the rest of the way.
And he must have been playing in excruciating pain in that seventh game. This was really something that would inspire teammates, that kind of bravery or, you know, putting the team ahead of your own physical comfort. On the other hand, he wasn't alone. Frazier had a pretty good game. Clyde scored 36 points, had 19 assists, 7 rebounds.
Arguably the greatest Game 7 ever played by a single player in the finals. And, of course, you know, it's funny. Everybody I interviewed for this book says, you know, what people always forget is that after Willis made those two shots, that Walt Frazier had one of the great games. And I finally concluded that if so many people had to remind me that Frazier played the game, then it probably wasn't forgotten by too many people in the first place.
You mentioned that Willis heard the game, Marv Albert announcing it, but New Yorkers heard the game only because it wasn't televised. Why wasn't it televised?
Well, there was a rule back then that blacked out games in the finals in the home cities during primetime because the owners understood we were in the early days of cable television, and the owners had this sense or this vision that television was going to be something that could really cash in on in the future. So they started, you know, in order to hype the gate a little bit, they started to hold back on certain games. And so that's what, you know, really launched Marv Albert's career, because so many New Yorkers, you know, saw that team and followed that team through his calls on the radio.
Well, now, of course, the TV money is one of the sources of conflict in the negotiations between the players and the owners.
It's interesting that today's conflict, you know, we constantly hear about the small markets and the big markets. That really began with the launch of the league, and it also, one of the instrumental players was Ned Irish of Madison Square Garden, who used his authority and his leverage as the the guy who had the biggest arena to bully the small market owners into accepting a deal where gate receipts would not be shared. The small market owners wanted to share a cut of the gate in the bigger arenas. Irish resisted and ultimately got his way. And that's where, you know, we're still fighting that battle today.
My guest is Harvey Arreton of the New York Times. His latest book, When the Garden Was Eden, Clyde the Captain, Dollar Bill, and the Glory Days of the New York Knicks, published by Harper's. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Harvey Arreton of the New York Times. His latest book, When the Garden Was Eden, Clyde the Captain, Dollar Bill, and the Glory Days of the New York Knicks, published by Harper's. It was all of this took place at a time of political turmoil. We had a couple of important political assassinations that had just happened. New York was entering into a rough period. The 70s, I remembered it as a bad time. The Vietnam War was still going on. Were the players involved in protesting the way so many other people were?
I wouldn't say they were actively involved in protesting, but, you know, in Bill Bradley, you had someone who had, you know, clear political aspirations. You had Phil Jackson, who was very much attuned with the anti-war movement. I think with the media, largely, the players, you know, tried to be You know, I think they tried to, you know, hold back on what they thought, but the guys on the team, they all told me that there was always a lot of discussion on planes and in the locker room, and I think the sports media was beginning to ask athletes certain questions. Remember, this was, you know, after the John Carlos Tommy Smith episode at the Mexico City Olympics in '68,
where they gave a Black Power salute.
Yes, Muhammad Ali in this period refusing to enter the draft. So there was a lot more questions, a lot of reporters asking, essentially, you know, which side are you on? Where do you come down on this whole war issue and civil rights, things of that nature? But I think Bradley used to take DeBuscher to, you know, political rallies against the war, you know, when they had a free afternoon on the road. So, yes, the players were certainly a lot more aware and getting involved.
DeBuscher also represents an earlier era in an odd way. There was a time when players could play baseball and basketball. I remember Gene Conley with the Boston Braves and the Celtics. DeBuscher was probably the last one to try that until Michael Jordan failed at it many years later.
Right, Dave was a pretty good pitcher. You know, Dave came from a blue collar family. Grew up in the shadow of a Chrysler plant in Detroit. And for a while, I think for several years, he did pitch, and he always said, you know, until the major league hitters figured out that he didn't really have much of a curveball and was sitting on his fastball, you know, then he decided to give it up. But I think he also, Dave was such the consummate team player that baseball, especially standing on the pitcher's mound, seemed lonely and too much of an individualistic game for Dave. He loved the whole spirit and camaraderie of basketball.
Well, one of the big problems in putting together a team is if you get a bunch of great players, they don't always gel well. What was it about this starting five, DeBuscher, Bradley, Reed, Barnett, that allowed them to do so well?
Well, they all had what we like to call high basketball IQ in the first place. But I think they all were at points in their career. I mean, I think it all really began. Some people like to say it began with Holzman. I like to say it began with Willis Reed.
Red Holzman was the coach.
Red Holzman was the coach and a wonderful coach who, you know, preached team values and see the ball on defense and hit the open man on offense.
Every coach tells his players to do that. Some coaches get their players to actually listen.
Well, he did, but I think, you know, again, he had a group of very mature players, it all started with the leadership of Willis Reed. I mean, he's an unusual man. He's a very proud guy. He grew up in the South, in the Jim Crow South. He came to New York. He was the second. He was drafted in the second round and always wanted to prove that he was worthy of being a first round pick.
But he'd gone to a black college, hadn't he?
He went to Grambling. Yes,
yeah. Which at that time would have meant that he didn't play on the kind of level that they expected a number one draft choices to play at.
Except at in those days, you have to remember that a lot of the traditional white schools, particularly in the South, did not recruit black players. So those teams tended to be a lot better than they probably are today. And Willis also played in the Pan American Games. So the thing about first round, second round, is that there were only eight teams to begin with. So being the second round pick meant you were the ninth pick of the entire draft.
Uh-huh. Well, it was apparent right from the start that he was a very great player. And you're saying he was also a great team player. Was he the kind of center that we're used to seeing today?
Well, I think, you know, comparatively, I mean, today he would probably be considered one of the more skilled players. I mean, Willis could go outside 15 feet from the basket, face the basket, shoot that nice little lefty jump shot. He could also put the ball on the floor and take it to the basket. He was not a 7-foot center, and he was listed about 6'9", 6'10", but he was probably... perhaps, you know, in his shoes, 6'8.5", but he just was the kind of player who I like to say was better than the sum of his parts. He had unusual leadership skills that come across in various sections of the particularly the 69-70 season, and not just on the nights of Game 5 and 7.
So why hasn't he been a better head coach, a more effective head coach?
I think Willis suffered.
And I'm not blaming you, Harvey.
Well, yeah. I mean, when I first started covering the Knicks in the late 1970s, he was coaching the team, and it was a story that I wrote in the New York Post where there were rumors about the possibility of him being replaced, and I asked him one day in Seattle, are these rumors, you know, upsetting the team? And he said, well, yeah, I've got a lot of young players. They want to know whether I'm in or out. And he said it more as a plea than an ultimatum. I wrote the story. The editors at the Post were salivating, Willis to Sonny Werblin, in or out. And when we got back from that West Coast trip, Werblin called a press conference and said, you're out.
Mm. Well, but he never really made it as a coach. Was it just the teams that he was handed?
Well, I think sometimes, you know, guys who really get it, who are consummate team players, have difficulty understanding that not every player, and in fact, as we went into that era, into the early 80s, when Willis was coaching, and he also coached the New Jersey Nets for a while, that a lot of the players were young, they were growing up in a different kind of system, and they weren't as committed as he was. And he had difficulty accepting the fact that they weren't as coachable as the guys that he had played with.
And then you look at this Knicks team. Bill Bradley deferred his professional career for 2 years to study at Oxford University. I just saw the statistics on the most recent All-Star game, and only one of the players in that game went through all 4 years of college. The largest number hadn't gone to college at all.
Well, yeah, you know, that's
changed a lot.
That's changed. I mean, the NBA in this latest negotiating, this collective bargaining negotiating, has, I think, you know, they now have a rule where you have to go to college at least for 1 year. But I think they would prefer it to be two. But the economics of the game really changed all that. It was difficult to put that lid back on the bottle once the money started getting to the point where you had a lot of kids coming from underprivileged backgrounds. They are, you know, not in college necessarily because they want to be there in the first place. And if they were good enough to play in the NBA, clearly Kobe Bryant, LeBron James, and Kevin Garnett were capable of making a living at 18 or 19 in the NBA. It was hard to keep them back in school.
My guest is Harvey Arreton of the New York Times. His latest book, When the Garden Was Eden, Clyde, the Captain, Dollar Bill, and the Glory Days of the New York Knicks. It's published by Harper's. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, the other key player, as we said, was Walt Frazier. Also not a top draft pick, was he?
Well, he was in the top five. I believe he was the fifth pick.
Oh, so that's pretty good.
Yes. And the only
but he's a Division II player.
Right. The only reason why he was picked that high was because during his senior year in college, he came into Madison Square Garden in the old NIT, which at that time was a very prestigious tournament. All 16 teams would converge on New York and play the entire tournament at the Garden. And Frazier had an unbelievable tournament. They had a very good team and actually had beaten several of the major college teams that year. They just weren't eligible for the NCAA tournament. And Frazier put on a great show, won the MVP, and Southern Illinois won the tournament. I believe they beat Marquette in the final.
Now, Phil Jackson missed that entire season, didn't he?
He missed the first championship season. He had had back surgery. And although he was fairly healthy by the time the playoffs came around, Red Holzman was the coach, and Eddie Donovan had been the general manager who helped construct that team. But he had left toward the latter stages of that season to take on the same role of an expansion team up in Buffalo. So Holzman was running the show, and he made a decision to keep Jackson inactive because that would enable him, the Knicks, to protect him in the coming expansion draft. And he knew that if he had brought him back onto the active roster, that he would likely have been taken by Donovan up in Buffalo.
Was he learning all that time about coaching?
Was
he talking to Red Holzman?
Phil did a lot of, prepared some scouting reports for Red during his inactive season. He sat with Red a lot. He sat with him on planes. Phil is the first to say that he is cast as a coach in the image of Red Holzman, and is delighted to have been a protege of Holzman, and is now the guy with the most championships ahead of Red Auerbach.
Well, we're talking about a team that seems to have had perhaps the highest IQ in the history of sports. We have members of the team going on to become a United States Senator, one of the winningest coaches in NBA history, a professor of education, the ABA League Commissioner, and in the case of Frazier, a man who seems to be a walking thesaurus.
Yeah, that he is. I hesitate to call the Knicks the smartest team of all time. I think New York, we as New Yorkers like to believe they are. It's kind of hard to consider them certainly the, well, I would consider themselves the intellectual equal of any team. But the Boston Celtics of their era, the Russell era, they were an awfully intelligent team. The Portland Trailblazers of the 1977 championship team, very, very intelligent team. I tend to think of those Knicks from, say, 69 through 73 as the perfect team for their time and place.
And then, well, one of the guy we haven't talked about is Dick Barnett, who was a great player, and he seems to be the forgotten man.
Always. And it's unfortunate because, you know, and Dick is the one guy in that starting five who was not in the Hall of Fame. And in the book, we talk about how he definitely should be, because not only did he play on, he played in the finals for the Lakers, he played on two championship teams in New York and three finals, plus he was the star of a three-time championship team in college, Tennessee A&I, under a Hall of Fame coach, John McClendon. And in those days, that was quite an accomplishment because, again,
that was an all-black team.
Because then those schools, you know, were putting out some real quality teams in the days before, you know, integration in a lot of the bigger schools.
Then, if anything, the team improves when Earl Monroe is added. He was with the rival Baltimore Bullets, and you would have thought that they would never have allowed him to come to the Knicks.
Well, it was a contract dispute. The Bullets were considered the small market team, and the owner was Abe Pollin, and Earl was, you know, vastly underpaid for being perhaps in those days the premier showman. I wouldn't call him the best player, but he was the premier showman of the NBA, and you know they just weren't going to be able to pay him the kind of money that he was worth to a bigger market team, and Earl has gone through a lot of reflection, you know, throughout his life as to whether that was actually the best move for him, because although he did wind up winning a championship, he does feel that, you know, creatively he had to sacrifice a heck of a lot to play with the Knicks.
And people said that he and Clyde could not share the backcourt duties, that there would be a real problem. We've seen it in some other instances where actually you put two guys who can shoot so well in the backcourt and they can't work it out.
Well, it was an example of a different time, a different mentality, and I think that the sacrifice Earl did make was that once the trade was made, you know, he came up to New York thinking, I'm going to show these people that I'm not only a great showman, but I'm also a great basketball player and I can play in any system. And the first thing he did when he got to New York on the day he was about to play in his first game was that he went to Holzman and he said, I don't want to be a starter. Dick Barnett has earned that. I'll find my way. I'll come off the bench for at least the foreseeable future. And he did.
It was one of the greatest players the Knicks ever had.
Averaged 11 points a game that first year with the Knicks. Can you imagine one of the agents or the shoe companies that, you know, that sponsor a lot of the great players today allowing that to happen in the first place?
Marv Albert speculates that if Willis Reed had stayed healthy, the Knicks of the early 70s could have won at least two more championships. You think it's true?
Well, you know, I would say that they probably, yeah, I would say one at least. They were clearly hitting their stride as a great team when, you know, the injuries began to take their toll on Reed. And Jackson maintains that Willis was never really the same after those 1970 injuries at the end of the season.
Now, there were a lot of role players who have been forgotten from these teams.
One of them, Mike Reardon, Cassie Russell, and Dave Stallworth were the primary three on the first team. Obviously, Jackson returned. on the second team, the second championship team in 1973, Dean Memminger, who had a great performance in Game 7 of the conference finals up in Boston. Stallworth was a fascinating story. He had left the team 2 years earlier, after the 68 season. He had suffered a minor heart attack, and doctors said, you can't play basketball anymore. He got second opinions 2 years later, came back, and actually was one of the key players in the fifth game when Reed got hurt.
And one of the greatest leapers in the history of the game.
That made that great shot where he drove the right baseline, came up and around under the basket and scooped it in over Wilt Chamberlain.
So just a few other people who've disappeared. What happened to Dancing Harry and Hawthorne Wingo?
Hawthorne Wingo,
one of the great names in the history of sport.
Yeah, and he was a classic role player, did play on the second championship team. When I say play, I mean sparingly. He died. He had problems, dealing with drugs in his post-playing career. He passed away. Dancing Harry, who actually came with Monroe from Baltimore, is still around. I believe he's back in Baltimore. But he was, he was a kind of mascot that the Garden really didn't feel was, didn't really fit in with the image of the Knicks. But it was sort of a concession to Monroe that, who brought that glamour and showmanship to the team to allow Dancing Harry to do his thing.
Just one more thing. The uniforms are quite different now. The pants are a lot baggier, for instance. When you see footage from the earlier time, isn't it like watching a different sport?
Yeah, it is. And I think sometimes the fans of today, when they see the players in their little tight short shorts, they're almost conditioned to see it as inferior because the players look so prehistoric. And so what they do is they wind up missing the fundamental intricacies of the sport that those guys were so good of, the little backdoor screens, the movement without the ball, the helping on defense, all the things that the Knicks were known and celebrated for. You have to look real close and get past the visual, watching the old tapes.
Harvey Arreton is one of our best sports writers. He's been with the Post, the News, and the New York Times. He's been with the Times since 1991. His latest book, When the Garden Was Eden, Clyde, the Captain, Dollar Bill, and the Glory Days of the New York Knicks. It's published by Harper's, and I want to thank you so much for being with us.
Absolute pleasure to be here, Leonard.